As soon as I get my dinghy in from the San Francisco Bay, we can get started. All right. You're right. We do have perfect attendance. That's awesome. All right. The time is 8:32 a.m. on April 7th, 2023, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact, and I have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Good morning, I'm present.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Buongiorno, I'm present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Please note that any time stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to a former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. Board members, thank you again today for your attendance. I'll just remind you, if you could please remember to use the raise your hand feature so that I can make sure to maintain just a little bit of order here on this beautiful Friday in Arizona. Board survey. So board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I want to recognize all the board members here today and for all of their hard work. It's not lost on me as we prepare for these meetings that there are hours and hours spent in terms of preparation and requirements from each of you. And I just want you to know that, as always, I appreciate your time and effort, as does board staff, in preparing for these meetings. Also like to acknowledge our wonderful board staff who keep us on the up and up with regards to all of the information that we have to attend to and getting it to us in a timely and well-packaged fashion so that we can get through that information, digest it, and be prepared for today's discussion. Also, I'd like to thank Ms. Galvin, our attorney, our representative from the Attorney General's office, for all of her assistance and all of her guidance that happens not only prior to this meeting, but then also inside the meeting as well. Attendance of the board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit. It is at if it is at least 4 hours long. Should its duration be 4 hours or more, make a note of the code that was provided, code words provided throughout the meeting. Note those down, and then you'll report that code back to board staff for the purpose of earning continuing education credit. Look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. It is possible that today's meeting will not be 4 hours in duration, and we thank you in advance for your understanding. Next, we'll proceed to a call for the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38431.02H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or other members of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda, if applicable. If you wish to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I'll be happy to call on you. All right. I do not see anybody unmuting, and I do not see any hands raised. So I think we'll move on from the call to the public. Thank you very much. Council update. Item 5, well, this is the board council's update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any updates for the board?
I have nothing at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Moving on. Agenda item 6 is the consent agenda. For the record, are there any recusals from items on the consent agenda?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I am recused from applicant Joanna Schumacher.
Thank you so much for that recusal. We'll note that. Any other recusals? Hearing none, any board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Are there any such requests? All right, hearing none. If there are no requests to remove the item, is there a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
All right, we're going to go ahead and say that we're going to start the race early today. But Dr. Malott, definitely on the first, the second, I'll leave that up to board staff to decipher. There was multiple winners there.
And Mr. Chair, can I just say, I don't get the opportunity to say this enough, but I want to thank our board staff for very high quality work in the executive director's report that they provide us in each meeting. Very good report, very concise, very thorough. So thank you, Ms. Packinen and staff.
Second that. My goodness. Yes, Addie.
Yes.
Well, thank you for sharing those accolades. I'm sure the board staff, that'll bring a smile to their face knowing that that is something that they, I know they spend a lot of time in preparing that. And so thank you for those comments. All right, so we have a first and a second on the consent agenda. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Just the one recusal, which we've noted. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Moving right along.
Oh, yep. Mr. Chair, we can go to agenda item number 7 for Dr. Worsley's self-report. She's present.
Very good. Discussion, consideration of possible action regarding self-report submitted by Jacqueline Worsley, PsyD. The board may vote to go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431.03A2 to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confidential by state or federal law and or ARS 38431.03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. Agenda item 7, Ms. Michelson, will you please provide a summary of this matter for the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this will be brief. On December 30th of 2022, Dr. Worsley notified staff in writing that she had been charged with a DUI the week before on December 21st and that charge was pending in court at that time. Dr. Worsley reported that charge within the 10-day requirement prescribed in statute, and she subsequently supplied all requested information to include the police and court records, which is in your file. The information reflects that she was charged with DUI to the slightest degree and 3 traffic violations. That DUI charge was ultimately dismissed in court as the prosecutor had filed a motion to dismiss this charge. A March 15th, 2023 judgment and sentence order reflects that she was found responsible for 2 of the traffic violations. And again, it noted that the DUI charge had been dismissed. That order requires that she complete a defensive driving program for the traffic violation. This does conclude my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions. Dr. Worsley may wish to address the board as well.
Thank you. First, any questions for Ms. Michelson? Just to be clear, so at this particular point, it has been dismissed. The judgment was the defensive driving class. That was the request of the judge in that case.
Correct. And that was issued about 2.5 weeks ago.
Yeah. Thank you. Very good. Any other questions for Ms. Michelson? Yes. Sure. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you. Ms. Michelson, has the defensive driving program been scheduled? Has the course been completed or been scheduled?
That would be a question for Dr. Worsley. At the time that she had sent me the order, it had just been a few days, so she may have some updates for you.
Okay. Thank you.
But then if there's no other questions, then we can move right into that. Dr. Worsley, are you present? I think you are.
Yes, present. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you're welcome to make a statement, and then we can also have you answer Dr. Stewart's question.
Yes, I'm Dr. Jacqueline Worsley, and I'm open to any questions that anybody might have. And as of last Saturday, I did complete the defensive driving course.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Worsley? All right.
I just wanted to make a comment. I appreciate Dr. Worsley reporting it within 10 days. It's a rare, the fact that you're familiar with our statutes. I just want to express my appreciation for that. That's something I know we have a lot of members on the call, and it is important to make a report regardless of whether you're charged or not. The minute there's a charge, the report has to be made within 10 days. So thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Would any of the members like to begin any discussion or make a motion?
I don't know if we'd... Well, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Dr. Meyer.
I don't know if we need a motion, do we? But my vote would be to take no action.
I would prefer that motion. Yes, thank you.
I would make a motion that we take no action.
Second that.
All right, Dr. Catarino's got the second. Any further discussion around this? All right, hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion unanimously carries. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, we can go to agenda item number 8 for Dr. Skinner's request. Her attorney is present.
Very good. It's like it when we kind of stay in order versus the renumbering of things. So number 8, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding self-report submitted by Stephanie Skinner, PhD, and her request for an extension to complete the fitness of for duty evaluation pursuant to the interim consent agreement and order for evaluation and practice restriction from complaint 23-12. The board may vote to go into executive session on any item on the agenda, or may vote to go into this on any item, or particularly this item on the agenda, pursuant to ARS 38431.0382, to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confidential by state or federal law, and or ARS 38431.03A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. Agenda item number 7, Ms. Michelson, will you please provide a summary of this matter for the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The board may recall that Dr. Skinner entered into an interim consent agreement on order back in October of 2022 for a pending complaint that indicated the following terms. During the pendency of that order, her license is suspended and she shall not practice in Arizona. That suspension shall continue until such time the board enters a final order. And she shall complete an evaluation within 45 days of the effective date of that interim order, unless otherwise extended one time by the executive director upon showing of good cause. Dr. Skinner's attorney, Mr. Carey, subsequently requested an extension for the evaluation and explained those reasons to staff. The executive director approved a 90-day extension as the interim order allowed for a one-time extension. On March 27th of 2023, board staff received a self-report from Dr. Skinner via her attorney indicating that on March 13th of 2023, she had been charged with a felony. The charge was reported within the 10-day requirement in statute, and that case is currently pending in court at this time. Dr. Skinner's attorney has requested a second extension for her to undergo the evaluation, which is before the board today for consideration. Mr. Carey is present and can articulate to the board his reasons for requesting this second extension. I do know in his correspondence, he proposed a 90-day extension for her to complete the eval, but the board may wish to consider a longer extension as it's possible that the case in court may not be resolved within those 90 days. Her license would remain suspended in the interim. So that concludes my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Michelson. Are there questions for Ms. Michelson?
Here.
Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Michelson, do we know what the felony complaint was?
Yes, the felony charge in the court charging document is disorderly conduct, recklessly handling a deadly weapon or dangerous instrument, and that is a Class 6 felony. And again, that was just that case is pending, and I believe Mr. Carey can update the board with respect to where that is at in the process.
Thank you.
Very good. Any further questions for Ms. Michelson before we get to the complainant and the attorney? All right, hearing none. Dr. Skinner, are you or your attorney present? I actually see Mr. Carey is here. If you guys would mind, please introduce yourselves. And you're welcome to make a statement to the board at this time.
Yes, this is Flynn Carey, counsel for Dr. Skinner. Chair Davey, members of the board, as you heard from Ms. Michelson, this is a case that she agreed to an interim suspension in order to get an eval. We did propose a evaluator who, in our experience with other boards, can navigate her right to remain silent on the underlying allegations. But after conversations with board staff, because they wanted to have a more fulsome evaluation without any obstacles, we decided to try to extend it out. And we're really before the board because the executive director has used her authority to extend it. And we do believe we'll need a little bit more time because right now the case is pending. It's pending up in Coconino Superior Court. As some of you may know, I do practice criminal defense as well. So I'm actually litigating that matter. Typically, in my experience with Coconino, it's about 3 to 6 months based upon where this case was put, which is in the early disposition process. I think they're looking at 3 to 6 months. I suggested to board staff 90 days only because I know this board likes to have some check-ins. We certainly would not object to a longer period. Certainly, once her case resolves, whether that's through trial, a plea, then the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent drops away and she can have a full conversation and discussion with the evaluator. So our thought would be there's no prejudice because she's already under an interim anyway. So it's not like she's out there working with clients. We just want to maintain the status quo, resolve the criminal case, and then we're going to put her in front of a fitness for eval or fitness for practice eval as soon as possible. So really, we wanted to just give you the update. Ask the board to use its discretion to see what type of extension it thinks is appropriate. Obviously, we would ask that you give the executive director her normal discretion to again extend it out one more time if necessary. And my hope is once that's all done, we can just get her an eval and then we can move this matter towards a final dispo instead of this interim status that we're currently in.
Thank you. Mr. Carey. And I don't believe that you answered. Are you making the only statement today?
I am today, yes, because she has necessarily, because of the pending criminal matter, invoked her right to remain silent, which case law does allow in board proceedings.
Thank you so much. I think we'll move to questions for you. Do board staff have any additional questions for Mr. Carey? And Mr. Carey, thank you for laying out the thought process around that and also your thoughts around allowing us to empower board, the executive director, to perhaps extend the time frame so that we can resolve the criminal matter that's in front of the courts and have that adjudicated before we move on to the fitness of duty test. So thank you for that explanation as well. Board members, do you have further questions for Mr. Carey? Yes, sir. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Mr. Flynn, Mr. Carey, thank you for being here. Do we have either you or your client, Dr. Skinner, provided the board staff with a copy of the police complaint?
We provided a copy of the complaint, which is the charging document. Okay. The discovery that's provided to us is protected under a rule, under Rule 15, that indicates we can't secondarily disseminate the material. However, I believe, and I don't want to speak for Jennifer, but I think she may have already obtained police reports through public records. And if she has not, we can make our public record version of the police report available to her. I just can't disclose the discovery version because they give that to us under protection.
Okay, thank you. A follow-up. The Class 6, is that an undesignated Class 6 felony at this point?
It's not. It's just charged as a 6. The way it will work is if a disposition is reached, she may be, from a plea perspective, she may be offered a undesignated offense, which under the law now would be treated as a misdemeanor for all intents and purposes until a final disposition at the end of probation. But right now, there's been no plea offer because we truly are right at the beginning. We have filed our notice of appearance about a week or two ago, and our first court date's what's called the telephonic pretrial, which is set for next Tuesday.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring it out for the board members that a class six can be negotiated down to misdemeanor, and then even either dismissed later on or quelled or something. What extension are you looking at now? Are you requesting of us?
So we requested, Dr. Stewart, 90 days with the idea that that empowers the ED is empowered to grant another extension. I think that will give us enough time to get through the court process. And typically we've stayed in touch with board staff. So once we noticed that we were not going to meet the deadline, we just reached out like we typically do to board staff and counsel to make sure that we're all on the same page about the case progress.
Okay. Thank you so much.
And Dr. Stewart, I would just say that, the 90 may be not enough. And so we may want to think about the extension for board staff to be able to make that happen. Thank you. Dr. Catarino, I believe you have your hand up.
Yes, Mr. Flynn, if she had the evaluation done now, would it have to be released to the court? Could it be kept confidential from the court so we didn't have to have the extension until the court case was over?
The issue she has is that if she gets the evaluation done now, my legal advice to her has to be to continue to take the fifth because she is facing legal jeopardy from the criminal case. And so the glitch we kind of have on this one is I want, and I think the board wants her to be able to go in and have full and free disclosure about everything so that it can make a fair assessment. What I propose is I do have a clinician who can kind of navigate the Fifth Amendment issues, but it just seemed like given that she's on an interim and there's no prejudice to the public right now, just to park this case until we get through the criminal side of it, because she will have to necessarily take the fifth. And there is case law. There's a case at the U.S. Supreme Court and then a case, I want to say, before the dental board in Arizona that specifically says that she is entitled to take the fifth. In these proceedings. And so from a legal advice perspective, while there's a pending criminal case, she would have to continue to take the fifth. So that's why the evaluation may not be as fulsome, which then again, I'm at a loss. I think that creates a situation where we have to send her back for maybe a second eval after the case is resolved. So we're just trying to be expedient and efficient with her resources and also not giving the board eval after eval.
No, I understand that. I just didn't know if that could be kept confidential or they could subpoena the results of that evaluation.
I can't guarantee. I mean, I think that I would leave it to your counsel about how counsel would respond on behalf of the board if there was a subpoena or a search warrant provided by the government. But the reality is because you are technically still the state of Arizona, we'd be invoking if we were compelled to do an evaluation, which would, I think, would negatively impact the quality of the evaluation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that. Other questions from board staff from Mr. Carey?
Sure.
Yes.
Mr. Carey, I'm not sure if you can speak to this or not, but is Dr. Skinner safe from a treatment perspective, receiving the care that she needs?
I certainly don't want to waive or disclose any therapeutic or attorney client. What I will say is when this matter does come before an evaluator or board staff for a more final disposition, there will be evidence of significant rehabilitative and mitigative steps. And those steps began almost immediately after the allegations in this case. So she has been in a significant period of reflection and rehabilitation that I think will be helpful to the board's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay. Would any of the board members like to begin the discussion or make a motion?
I would.
Ms. Shreve has a question.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Ms. Shreve. Oh, there you
go. I was going to make a motion, but go ahead, Dr. Stewart.
Just for the discussion, I think it's very reasonable, especially if there are criminal charges pending. We certainly don't want to interfere with that process, nor with Dr. Skinner's constitutional rights. An evaluation after the charges are resolved would be fantastic. At that point in time, we will certainly have more information as suggested by Mr. Carey. I'm certainly in favor of that. You know, a longer extension than the 90 days, I think, would be appropriate. It may just simply take that long, especially in the northern counties. Sometimes we don't have the efficacy of judicial functioning as maybe a metropolitan area, and it may just simply take that time to get through the process. I think it's a very reasonable request, and I'm certainly in favor of long extension plus to provide Ms. Pakanan with the ability to extend further if warranted. Thank you.
Is that a motion? Oh, I'll make a motion. Dr. Stewart, was that a motion or?
Well, it's a discussion, but I move that we extend the requirement for evaluation, fit for duty evaluation, 180 days. And authorize the executive director to extend further if warranted.
And how, this is Jean Galvin, how long are you going to authorize Ms. Pakanan to grant another extension for? And that's like 90 days or another 180?
180 was the motion, Ms. Galvin. Mm-hmm.
I understand the motion was for 180 days extension. He also included in his motion the authority for Ms. Pakanan to grant an additional extension. So I was just wondering for clarification, how long will the extension authorized by Ms. Pakanan be, if needed?
Yes, Ms. Galvin. Up to 180-day extension beyond that, I think is very reasonable in this situation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that motion, Dr. Stewart. Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Any further discussion? Hearing no discussion. Ms. Galvin, would you like a roll call on this?
Not necessary. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And in that case, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion unanimously carries. Mr. Carey, board staff will be in touch with you, obviously, to stay abreast of the information or stay abreast of how things transpire with the criminal case and to make sure that we're staying within the guidelines that the board has extended in this particular case.
Thank you for your time. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the first CE code word. If the meeting is long enough, 4 hours or more, then the first CE code word is jelly beans. Jelly beans. Thank you.
Very good. Board staff, are we going to continue on to nine or are we going to jump around a little bit? Oh, Dr. Stewart's got the visual.
I have the jelly beans to go with that.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm just scanning the attendance. I think we may as well go to agenda item number 9. So we'll just keep in sequence then.
Okay, very good. Number 9, discussion, consideration, or possible action relating to the rehabilitation and monitoring program known as RAMP for a participant 2022-01. Due to the confidential terms of RAMP, I move that the board meet in executive session to discuss confidential health information and or to receive legal advice. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Multiple seconds there. Is there any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion carries. Thank you very much. Magic is about to happen. So while we're waiting for Ms. Galvin to make her way back, just want to double check that participant 2022-01 for this particular agenda item is still not present. I am not seeing anybody raise their hand or unmute themselves.
And Dr. Davey, we do have Ms. Galvin present, so we may proceed.
Okay. Ms. Galvin, we were just double checking to make sure that while we were in executive session, the participant or her legal representative did not come online, and we have confirmed that no one has spoken out to that effect.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. With that, do we have a motion with regard to this matter, Board?
I would like to file a motion.
Yes, please, Dr. Medina.
The motion is to open a complaint against participant 2022-01 due to noncompliance to the consent agreement.
Okay.
A second.
Okay, we have a first and we have a second from Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion on this matter? Hearing none. Would we like a roll call for this, Ms. Galvin, I assume?
It is not necessary just to open a complaint. No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And then I guess then I will ask all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion unanimously carries. All right. We will continue following the agenda as it's laid out, board staff, on the number 10. Are we good with that?
That's perfect, Dr. Davey.
All right. First on along, number 10, discussion and consideration, possible action relating to the Committee on Behavior Analysts recommendation regarding the following complaint and or initial case review of the following complaint. This is complaint number 2318 against licensee Paige Huff. Agenda item 10, Dr. Davis-Wilson, you're the lead for this complaint. So will you please provide a summary followed by the recommendation forwarded to the board by the CBA?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I apologize. I actually had to close my web browser because it froze, but I think I'm good to proceed. It's pretty basic. So Ms. Huff came before the committee regarding a complaint received by a former employee. The former employee had left the organization without notice and cited several supervision concerns, including what she felt was misinformed as to when her supervision hours could start, who could conduct her supervision, and who was overseeing those services. The committee did review the complaint, and other than just some casual, you know, conversations around some potential additions to the supervision contract, there was no noted concerns. It does appear that the complaint or that the licensee did meet the requirements of the supervision contract, and we did not note any concerns at the committee level, and we're recommending that this complaint be dismissed.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Davis-Wilson? Not hearing any. Ms. Huff, are you present? Don't believe I see her. And I don't believe she indicated that she was going to be here. So not seeing that.
Mr. Chair, I did not hear back from either Ms. Huff or the complainant, and I don't see either.
Yeah, I was just scanning the list. I did not see complaint CA on here either. So I guess, you know, I'll open it up if there are any other questions for Dr. Davis-Wilson. If not, we can proceed to a motion. I'll go ahead and make the motion to accept the committee's recommendation for this to be dismissed.
Second.
First, a second. Any further discussion? All right. No discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstaining? Motion unanimously carries. Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson, for providing the lead on that. We'll continue with you as we move to number 11, discussion, consideration, and possible
Mr.
action.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for interrupting. I guess the parties are here. Right. I wasn't sure if they had joined. Looks like they are. Okay, we can go ahead.
We're here, and this incognito is Tim Nelson.
Yes. We will make sure to note that. Discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to the initial case reviews of the following complaint. So this is complaint number 2317, Claire Sterling. Agenda item number 11A, Dr. Davis-Wilson, you're the lead for this complaint. So will you provide a summary followed by the recommendation forwarded by the board by the CBA?
Mr. Chair, I first want to just give the same disclosure that I gave during the committee review, and that is that I was during COVID, one of the early instructors for Ms. Sterling. And I have no reason why that I could not proceed with an unbiased review. To provide a summary of this case, and I did get my Safari back up. Ms. Sterling is licensed by this board. She does reside in Washington and provides telehealth services through her organization. We received a complaint from the school district of her client, of her 14-year-old client, who had concerns related to a chronic healthcare form that Ms. Sterling had submitted to, or that Ms. Sterling had signed for the family to be able to submit. The committee reviewed the complaint, and while they weren't as concerned about the qualifications of whether or not she was qualified to fill out this form, we did note several concerns related to the form, specific to the relevant information provided on the form. And that was that Ms. Sterling did attest to specifically addressing the attendance issues in school. However, during the committee review, we were unable to substantiate that information. The treatment records, while treatment appeared to be going well, the concern was not the quality of the treatment that was being provided. We were unable to see the treatment of that specific school issue. Ms. Sterling has provided a substantial amount of documentation. Her agency has supported her through as well. She did respond to the complaint in a timely fashion. She was also present at the CBA meeting and answered all of our questions. Upon the review, we did recommend that this be forwarded to the full board for an initial case review, citing concerns with providing services that are unnecessary, as well as a few ethics code and the ethics codes violations regarding responsibility to clients and some care coordination expectations that are set forth by our board, but also by our ethics code, but also within the Arizona system, children's system of care for behavior health. And so we landed on those as being our primary concerns. And since the committee meeting, it does appear that Ms. Sterling has retained counsel that has provided a substantial amount of information. The organization also did a second internal review with regards to the concerns that we did present in the committee. Again, I think that the only portion that I'll re-summarize again, because I'm not sure it's clear in the written record, it does not appear that the response matches that, but our concern was linked back to the document as far as the document stating that specific issue was being addressed and us being able to it was unsubstantiated as to whether or not that really was being addressed. And we were unable to get answers from Ms. Sterling that gave or lent to confidence that was being addressed, and there was nothing in the record that indicated that the school attendance was being addressed. And that concludes my summary, but I am happy to answer any questions that the board members may have.
Yes, are there any questions for Dr. Davis-Wilson? All right, I don't see any questions. Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Ms. Sterling, you and your attorney are present. I see you there. And now you have the correct names. We no longer have to refer to either of you as 10. Please introduce yourself for the records, and you are welcome to make a statement to the board at this time. Please do your best to keep that under 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a statement, but I'm going to let Claire go first. She has a statement as well.
Hi, everyone on the board. I am Claire Sterling. I wanted to thank everyone for this opportunity. I want you guys to know that going through this opportunity or this experience has led me to do a serious reflection on my practice and how I'm interacting with my clients and how I'm providing my services as well. Of course, I want you guys to know that my practice, I'm making sure that my practice meets all of the board statutes and rules, follows our ethical code, meets my company's expectations, as well as my own expectations for my own practice. I also want you guys to know how much I love this job. I grew up with several family members with disabilities, so I'm a little nervous, but that's why I love this job. Even though a lot of our clients make very, very small progress, it means the world to me. Let's see. So with this client, I've established a very effective relationship with them and watched him meet so many targets, things that he's never done before, which has been amazing to be part of that. I have seen his behavior improve over time and received overwhelmingly positive social validity reports from family members who have thanked Centria and me personally for our services for their son, for doing things that he's never done before. While my client is very, very shy at first, and he will not talk to you or look at you or anything once he warms up, he's the funniest kid I've ever met. He will be cracking jokes and he'll like razz on his brothers and everything. And it's just hilarious. I've definitely loved working with his family and loved seeing his growth throughout this whole thing. While my client comes from this amazing family, they have a lot of challenges on all sides of it. So even with that, even with all these challenges, such as sharing a room with 5 other people, he is making huge strides with our treatment. And again, reaching those goals that mom has always hoped for him, including showering every day, whereas he used to shower maybe once a week. But now he's showering every single day. He's cutting his nails, which he's never done before. He's never tolerated that either. He's tolerating non-preferred tasks. He's following instructions at home. He's even relinquishing his most preferred reinforcers, those electronics, as we know, are kids' favorite things. He's finally giving them up without problem behavior, which is incredible to see. He's even had a blood draw for the first time without having to be physically intervened by medical staff, which has been amazing. There's been huge improvements in his noncompliance. Again, family have been telling me that they are extremely thankful for us and just can't imagine where they'd be without us. So because of all of this, I know that I'm still learning. Obviously, I'm very new. So this is always a learning experience. I know even from my teachers and everything, we are always going to be learning in this field. There's always something new. And just with our SBT wave, right, there's always something that comes up in this field that we change our practice because of it. So this has definitely been a learning experience for me and changed my practice, where now I am asking for guidance from my supervisor. If I'm presented with any kind of form that's not from Centria, I am making sure that all of my documentation is complete. I'm over-documenting now, if anything. Making sure that everything is, all of my requests even to gain information is also documented as well. I'm making sure to put all of that correspondence in that client record and not just on the Google Drive. I'm also making sure to have all of my families identify those stakeholders, and I'm being persistent and providing deadlines and everything with all of my families to make sure that they're providing me with those ROIs, with those stakeholders. And I have been persistent in having those CFT meetings established. Again, I love this job. It means a lot to me. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I would just like to address the specific allegations, and I think Dr. Davis Wilson's comment about the school attendance issue. As Clara said, she's really spent countless hours with this particular family, seeing strides that this child is making and seeing significant declines in interfering behaviors and noncompliance. As Dr. Davis Wilson mentioned, Centria's internal ethics committee did a review of this and made some recommendations that Claire undergo additional education, specifically around documentation forms, that kind of thing. And that's been completed. But I also did want to just draw your attention to page 2 of the committee's report, which is in your packet. And because I am not a BCBA and articulate on these particular matters, I did just want to, I think this addresses a little bit of the school attendance issue and why the at-home, why services are being provided at home to address the toleration and modification of behavior at home, because that seems to be where the issues are. It's not really at school. So just on page 2, it says a review of Ms. Sterling's supervision notes, parent training notes, and treatment plan reveals that the services provided to the client incorporated a number of best practices identified in the research literature relating to addressing school refusal. As the behavior was occurring within the home with the caregivers, i.e. tantrums, the instruction took place in the home and involved parent training in the implementation of contingencies and behavioral contracts. Concurrently, Ms. Sterling and the behavior techs were working with the client directly on toleration of non-preferred activities, emotion recognition and regulation, self-care and safety skills. And then concludes that at least the ethics committee didn't believe that Ms. Sterling's behaviors were unnecessary, unsafe, or unprofessional for a behavior analyst. And with respect to the standard 3.01, the finding was that at the core of the standard is the principle of maximizing benefits while minimizing any potential harm or discomfort while respecting an individual's right to autonomy. Ms. Sterling's treatment plan and program goals were centered around the priorities identified through collaboration with the client and his caregivers. Teaching procedures and interventions aimed at addressing interfering behaviors incorporated the use of skills-based treatment and client choice. During the course of the therapy, the client demonstrated progress across several domains that were identified as priorities identified by the client and his caregivers, including social communication, self-care skills. Again, her behavior and approach to care for this client demonstrated regard to her client's rights and responsibility to maximize benefits and do no harm. With respect to identifying stakeholders, I mean, Claire has, she says she's being more persistent with her clients now to identify stakeholders. In this particular case, she did try to obtain a release to speak to school personnel, but that was not obtained until last month. And so now she did reach out to school personnel. She's also reached out to the case manager at La Frontera to set up CFT meetings. And I think those are underway as of next week. As for the chronic health condition form, I feel like this one's been kind of beaten to death, but she now knows obviously to ask for guidance from her direct supervisor. She didn't put anything on the form that was inaccurate. You know, there was some complaint that she had her contact information on there. Unfortunately, this was just a really poorly devised form. It didn't define certified health professional, and thinking you're a board certified behavioral analyst is, you know, a certified professional. So there was just confusion and misunderstanding on Claire's part. It obviously won't happen again. I don't think Claire signing this form caused any harm or could have caused any harm to GB. The whole purpose of this form under the statute, which is ARS 15346, again, which wasn't cited on the form, is to help a student who's chronically absent, which this child was, to get homework accommodations to keep up with school. So by her signing it, although she wasn't apparently authorized under statute to do it, it was really to assist the client keep up with school. Claire's a detailed, compassionate, dedicated practitioner. She works collaboratively with clients, families, and stakeholders. And these are the words that come from her direct supervisor, who was planning to be here today to address the board during the call to public, but unfortunately has a family emergency, so he wasn't able to attend. So I'm speaking his words through me. His letter is in your packet. That's from Brett Newby. And I want to, again, not lose sight of the fact here that GB who together with his family do face very significant challenges beyond his own. They do continue, and he continues to make progress towards his therapy goals, in large part due to, you know, Claire's effort and the behavior technician's effort. Again, while she's new to this profession, she's continuing to learn and she works hard. She's dedicated to her clients and she wants to see them succeed. If the board members have any questions, Claire and I are happy to respond.
Mr. Chair, you're muted.
And I just not hear my thank you. I was just thanking them both for their responses, particularly Ms. Sterling appreciates the reflection and the path that you outlined with regard to having encountered this matter. I think that that, you know, as you said, you were, you know, young BCBA, young LBA, that does show some wisdom there with regard to improving your practice and improving the services that you're providing in the community. Thank you. Board members, any questions that we have for Ms. Sterling or the attorney? Dr. Milan, is your hand up? For some reason, you're at the top of my screen. Nope, I don't believe it is. Sure. Yep, thank you, Mr. Dr. Stewart.
Yeah, thank you. What motions need to be made to resolve this?
Well, I believe we can, if we feel as if the documentation that has been provided answers some questions with regard to making sure that the services were provided, were in line, and that we believe that the information and verbal statements here today clear up any concerns with regard to statutes that may have been violated, then we have the ability to go ahead and dismiss it. Other motions could be to provide any one of the array of non-disciplinary or disciplinary actions that we have at our disposal. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
I move to dismiss the errors or misinformation or missteps certainly been brought to Ms. Sterling's attention. As the attorney already outlined, she has received additional training in record keeping and forms and compliance with records. And in consideration of that, I'd like to go ahead and dismiss this.
I'll second that.
Very good. So we have a first, a second by Mr. Nguyen. Mr. Nguyen, thank you very much. Any further discussion around this matter? Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and perhaps I'm going to ask this question to Ms. Galvin, but I want to note that it's procedural, but maybe legal, and we might need to go into executive session. But this is a first hearing, and we have opened it up for questions to the applicant. We have not completed deliberations. I'm concerned that we are not aligned with the procedural steps by making a motion at this point.
I would agree. It seems that we kind of accelerated the process a little bit without an opportunity to ask questions.
Fair enough. So we can go ahead and get back on track to that. We can pin the motion at this particular point. Is that acceptable, Ms. Galvin?
It is.
Very good. So with that, I think to get back on track of the point of order here, we've got, let's see if the complainant is available. LB did not see the complainant, nor do I believe we had confirmed her participation, correct, board staff?
Correct. She did not indicate if she was participating today or not.
All right, very good. Then we'll circle back to, does anyone on the board have questions for Ms. Sterling or Ms. Weiswig?
Thanks, Weig.
Yep, I was going to get there. It's going to take me a second. Thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Dr. Malott.
Oh, you're first on my screen, but you can go, Dr. Malott.
Happy to go.
Oh, my questions are actually later for deliberations. So let Ms. Dr. Wilson go.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you. Ms. Sterling, on the CBA meeting, one of the points that I was sticking on was kind of that CFT process and kind of the specifics to Arizona's children's system of care, which is unique and you know, it comes from other, you know, legal settlements, and it, you know, it's embedded in different aspects of our contract and our work. I can tell that you've, you know, kind of done your research and looked around on that. Can you just describe for us kind of what you've learned about that system of care, and just a little bit more on how, what procedures you're going to do if, when practicing in Arizona, serving the children that are in the Arizona Medicaid system, to just help facilitate that for families?
Yeah, I know, specifically for, this client, and well, most of my clients, what I've done is I reached out to, the parents and asked who are they seeing, in either, case management, right? Cause I know a lot of parents are overwhelmed with all of, you know, just all of the different services, all of the different people, who are involved. So, asking them, you know, who's your case manager? A lot of the time, parents have no idea. They don't know who that means. Same with social worker, something like that. So a lot of the time I ask, like, who will, give you that recommendation for OT or help you find that person or speech or something like that. And so I've really worked to help families identify these different stakeholders. Same with if they are receiving medication for something, who is that person, right? And so I asked family this as well, for this client. I said, who is prescribing this kid medication? Who is your family did know who case manager was in this case? So I asked for that as well. And so for these clients, once I'm identifying that stakeholder, what I'm doing is I'm asking parents first to sign that ROI. With this family specifically, parent always says, yeah, okay. And I kind of never gets to it, right? So what I did was I provided a deadline. I need this by this date. And so I'm really having that follow through and continuously, hey, I need that form today and all of those things. Once I get that form, and on that form, it includes contact information. So I'm using that contact information, reaching out to that person, CCing the family as well, so that they are obviously involved. And then attempting to set up those CFT meetings. And I am a very direct person. So I will just email the case manager and say, hi, I am the BCBA on this case. I want to do a CFT. When are you available? And so that's what I've been doing with my clients.
That's fantastic. And, you know, one of the points that you make of families may not know, one of the points that I made on the committee is that ABA is the strange place of nobody knows whether we should be housed in medical or behavioral health. And so unique to all behavioral health services, ABA is the only one that doesn't require the CFT process to initiate services. But it is a process that is required should care coordination be imminent for standard of care. And so have you thought of, strategies that you might take to what if the family says, no, we really just don't have, a case manager assigned to us. But you're billing a funder that you, you know, would fall under kind of the settlement in Arizona Visions. Have you put any thought into kind of what your next steps would be there?
Yeah. So if they don't know who the case manager is, right. I'm also asking who's prescribing other services, maybe, therapy, maybe speech. I do have, and with my other clients in the past, I have met with, speech therapy and OT, and we've been able to overlap those sessions as well. So being able to coordinate care with those other therapies, also reaching out to, prescribers of medication, right. So that we can provide that behavioral data and see if there are, correlations, right, with those, medication changes and everything. If I am not sure, right, in those gray areas of this family really has no idea, I'm reaching out to my supervisor. I talk to my supervisor on a daily basis because I am new and obviously he has much more experience than I do. And luckily with Centria, we have such a huge team, where, I mean, as you guys know, throughout all of our documentation, right, they really come through. And so I'm able to reach out to a bunch of people. If my supervisor doesn't know, then we are asking everybody. We have a bunch of group chats as well with all of our Tucson BCDA team. And so I'm also asking them as well. So definitely reaching out to ask for guidance in those situations. Luckily, I haven't had that yet. So I haven't had to go that route. I have been able to identify either OT, speech, medical doctor, or case managers for my clients.
Yeah. Fantastic. And I would, you know, just encourage, I think you answered the question by saying that you go to your supervisor, but I would, you know, encourage, at the end of the day, you're still the licensed professional, but to perhaps encourage the supervisor and the organization to get familiar with the health plan liaisons, because that would be the other contact if you're not able to get that information. And I think we get stuck in that HIPAA piece, but when they're all under that system of care, the ROIs don't necessarily apply because of coordination of care. So that would be the only thing. I think going to your supervisor was a great answer, but I also would just encourage that you work with health plan liaisons as well, just so that you guys are able to meet the compliance. I appreciate that the organization's ethics committee reviewed this. I know the compliance committee reviewed this. They did a very thorough job. I think the challenge and the concern that I raised in CBA that I still think is present, not necessarily towards you, but I think the challenge is these are not individuals that are practicing within the Arizona system of care. And so when you are going to be practicing in that system, to just, you know, be able to be familiar with, or have the team familiar with, those contracts and how those things kind of intertwine. I have just one more comment. It's not a question, but I have reviewed your session notes since the CBA meeting, and I just wanted to commend you on how you've made those improvements in the documentation, because there's distinct clarity in what is being documented since the CBA versus what we were trying to look for before. And so I really, really do appreciate you taking that feedback and just very quickly applying it. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions from anyone on the board for Ms. Sterling or for Virgin? All right. So I think, Dr. Malott, you said your question was for deliberation. So if we're okay, we can go back to the motion that's at hand and open that up for discussion. Or if you'd like to have that prior, that's up to you.
I don't know, Dr. Davies, it's really hard to hear you. I don't know if anyone else is having that problem.
Yeah, but I was too, but I think you wanted me to speak, Dr. Davies. So I'll go ahead and speak. I guess I needed to ask both of you, Dr. Davis-Wilson and Dr. Davies, you know, as I read through it, I'm just wondering, you know, I really appreciate everything that Ms. Sterling has done to remediate and improve. But at the end of the day, as you know, when we do committee reviews, and the fact that it came from BCBA without a determination, you know, it came up for review, was there a statute violation, even if it's been corrected by now?
Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you want to respond to that? I think we may. Go ahead, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Malott, we spent quite a bit of time on that exact conversation, that exact question in the committee review. And after deliberation, and we were able to hear from the complainant, which did involve kind of some historical information about school attendance, and then how school attendance kind of dwindled, and then how school attendance was almost non-existent. And so we did have a little bit of that in consideration. And in looking at the documents at the time, and I think the committee members did a really good job in trying to elicit a response around that, how that non-compliance was then being generalized from the home program back into the school. And I think that where, despite multiple committee members trying to reframe some of the questions
from yours.
And I don't know if somebody is not muted, if they could mute themselves. when we were trying to reframe that, we were trying to see how the how that statement of we are specifically addressing the school attendance, we couldn't find that connection. Despite, I mean, there was a lot of really creative reframing of questions that the committee was doing. Yes, I do understand that the treatment during the sessions, which all occurred in the evenings after school, were going very well. I do understand that the individual was making progress. The concern that we kind of deliberated on at the committee level was just that statement of we are specifically addressing this school issue, which would give another professional perhaps the idea that that this will, you know, be part of a resolution, and then tying that into the other Arizona systems of care where that coordination and collaboration with the other providers, you know, we had documentation to have reason to believe that there was a health home involved, that there was CF, the school did attest that the school was attending CFT meetings. So there were meetings going on in this collaboration that the behavior analyst was not a part of. And again, the appearance was, hey, this.
Can I pause? I got the treatment part, and I know you went over that, but I'm going back to that form, the chronic health form, which she wasn't qualified to complete. Does that fall? That's the question I'm asking. I'm really looking at not so much all the treatment aspects. And I think at this point, we're deliberating.
Yeah, I agree.
I just wanted to let you know we dropped off for about 3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
We missed. I don't know what happened to our internet connection, so I'm sorry, but we missed most of what Dr. Davis Wilson just said.
Yes. Okay. So I think Dr. Milan,
Mr. Chair,
I think we are in deliberations at this particular point, so that's fine. Dr. Davis Wilson, if you want to just respond to Dr. Milan.
Yeah. So Dr. Malat, I know that was a long-winded answer back, but so that posed two questions on that form. One, was she qualified to provide that form? And I think that in deliberations at the CBA level, we kind of went back and forth. We are classified by the health plans and in our billing a qualified health professional. And so we could see where, and then I believe, you know, in some of the other statutory language, it says if you are licensed by Title 32, which she would otherwise be. So our concern at that point, we kind of mitigated the issue of whether or not she was required, like eligible to sign that form. And the concern became just that focus of the rationale behind the signing of the form was an attestation that treatment was being provided for that particular issue. Yet we couldn't find anything in the record that indicated that particular issue was where treatment was being provided.
Okay, so the fact that not qualified to provide the diagnosis, you know, because we've seen that, I know, with psychologists who sometimes talk about medication, and, you know, we have added concern because they're not qualified, you know, and kind of stepping in that realm. And so providing a diagnosis. So I'm just trying to get those things clear.
Yeah, so I
appreciate everything.
Yeah, I'll be very clear on that. Like, we did not, in the discussion at the committee level, we were very clear that she was not providing the diagnosis at all. That was not the purpose of what was going on. That was
even
not
though it was on the form.
Yeah, she essentially provided what the diagnosis was. It was not her making that diagnosis. That diagnosis, I believe, came from off on Terra, if I remember correctly, or a previous provider. And so essentially.
Those were my questions, and I was relying on y'all to help me understand.
And so I will also just ask your question that I think upon, you know, review of the more information that we provided in between the CBA and now, I think it's really pushing me towards the idea that there's not a statute violation. I think there is definitely something to Dr. Davis Wilson's point that we've got a larger system issue that we need to work on. But that's kind of my thoughts at this point. Dr. Davis Wilson. And then Dr.
Yeah, Mott. I just wanted to Dr. Mott, to your point, we did confirm that that the La Frontera report was included with all of the documentation, so the school would have the actual diagnostician. And then we did just generally advise that in the future, making sure that if you do make a statement, that you put those clarifying pieces of by so-and-so per X report, so that those connections are there. So we did provide those recommendations to clarify that for her.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Meyer, you did have your hand up, but now
I've put it back down after hearing that Dr. Wilson's response to that.
Very good. Okay. Any further deliberation? Dr. Stewart's back on. You got to mute yourself there, Dr. Stewart, if we're going to hear your brilliance.
I don't know about brilliance. I would like to unpin my motion and reassert my motion.
Yes, let's go ahead and do it. So I believe we have a motion. We had a second by... Yeah, we had Mr. Wynn had the second. Any further discussion around the motion to dismiss this case?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment as far as the whether or not this rises to a statutory level. I think that I just want to state that I still remain concerned that there are behavior analysts licensed providing services in the state and not familiar with the various aspects of Medicaid that are specific to our state. As a result, that can create, and if you understand the history of where those specifics came in, they came from death lawsuits and other very, very significant points in time in which failure for the behavioral health system to coordinate care was problematic. And so I do think that by the school refusing to accept the form, it kind of stopped the impact that could have happened had the form then been able to be used to not access an appropriate education. And so I throw that out there because I'm comfortable with because the impact, you know, didn't go to that individual. However, I still think it's very important to note that that this could very quickly impact public safety for some of these members if providers are not following those aspects of the Medicaid system when you are a Medicaid provider.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. I think Dr. Davis Wilson made an excellent point previously that these are systemic issues within the rules and regulations and not necessarily a violation of ethics of this particular person. And I call the question.
Yep, let's call the question. We probably do not need a roll call since this is an informal, correct? We just need a all in favor, say aye. Oh, go ahead.
No roll call is necessary on a motion to dismiss.
Very good. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Oh, thank you. Any opposed? Hearing none. Any abstaining? Hearing none, motion unanimously carries. This is dismissed. Thank you, Ms. Sterling, very much for your discussion points today. Greatly appreciated those, and look forward to you serving a long career as an LBA here in Arizona and being an advocate for children in need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your service, too.
And I just, can I make a comment? I just want to say, I think your CBA meetings are probably very, very informative for clinicians because you'll use it as like a teaching moment or lots of teaching moments, you know, so appreciate the care that you'll take in educating future and especially new professionals.
Thank you. It's a balance that we try to strike between the meeting and the opportunity to kind of move our profession along. And Dr. Davis Wilson is does a really good job of that consistently, as do other committee members. With that, let's go ahead and do a cover break. We are, you know, moving right along on the agenda. We can give a second code word, but based on the remaining items, I'm not sure we're going to make it to 4 hours, but we can go ahead and give that in case something crazy happens. But we'll come back. Let's say we come back at 10. Do we want 10 minutes or 15 minutes? I'm open to either. Who's going to say something first?
Can we make it shorter? I have to leave very quickly.
And so good. So 10 minutes. Let's go. Let's be back at 10:25, and we will fly through the remainder of the agenda. Thank you so much, Ms. Michelson. Did you see my? I sent you a quick question
back. Can we confirm that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Looks like we have all members back, and we can proceed to agenda item number 12 for Dr. Moore's accommodations request.
Thank you very much. Discussion, consideration, possible actions regarding related accommodations for Jessica Morris ID. Ms. Fowles, will you provide an update to that matter?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Board members, Dr. Moore has taken the ECPP twice. She has submitted a reapplication for a third attempt. It was approved by the board on March 10th last month. The accommodations that were included in that application were not current. They were from her first reapplication. And the committee discussed this, and they had asked me why there wasn't an update. At that moment, I couldn't remember exactly what had happened. I was thinking I didn't have a provider letter. What I didn't have was Dr. Moore's request. I had the provider letter. I received Dr. Moore's request this week. So what she's asking for is double time. Previously, the board granted time and a half. Water bottle, which is the same. Separate room, which is the same. A noise machine, which is new. And extra dry erase boards, which is new. And the provider letter was received in March, and it referred to a request for therapeutic music that she could listen to as she took the exam. I emailed ASPPB regarding this because we did not have, that's not listed on ASPPB's accommodations list. And I received an email back that, no, this is not acceptable. They can't do it for security reasons, but she offered the noise machine. So when Dr. Moore sent her email, her emailed letter this week, she changed her request to the noise machine because I had notified her of this response from ASPPB. So it is up to the board if they wish to grant any or all of these accommodations. And I do not believe she is present with us. And that is my summary. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fowles. Do board members have questions for Ms. Fowles?
In terms of dry erase boards, how many are we talking about?
As far as I know, Dr. Millett, she did not indicate in her letter an amount. She is only allowed one, and they take it away and replace it. If she wants it, she can't keep additional ones for her notes.
And this is in terms of the noise machine. I mean, what are we talking about? Because the system that must not be named ALEXA, because my system will come up otherwise. I mean, it's connected to the internet, and I think the whole idea is to not have anything that is connected that way. And are we talking of Michael Jackson music? Or, I mean, I'm just curious. I have so many questions.
She had requested, as far as music, she wanted to listen to classical or jazz, but the ASPPB won't allow any music. She can have a noise machine that they have to approve. It's a standalone white noise machine. The candidate would need to provide make and model and photos of the machine. and ASPPB will work with Pearson View Testing Centers regarding the type of machine she can use.
I have a question. Yes. How did we determine last time that she was given time and a half, this time she requests double time? How do we make the determination between those two, or how was that done in the past?
We generally refer to the medical practitioner's recommendation.
Okay.
Dr. Katarina, is that your only question?
Yes, it is. I'll have to take my hand down. Sorry.
That's all right. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Dr. Meyer.
I mean, I think we're pretty good at trying to provide appropriate accommodations, but this seems to be getting a little out of control. The Pearson's rules are you get one whiteboard, and I think that is sufficient. I think if they're going to do the noise making machine, great. Again, the music, no. It's like reasonable accommodations, fine, but I'd say this is exceeding that.
Thank you. I think before we kind of move into deliberations, I mean, unless it's a question for Ms. Fowles, if not, let's just check to see if Dr. Moore is present today. I don't believe she is, correct, board staff?
I don't believe so.
Okay. If she is, please, if you're here, please unmute yourself. If not, then I think that's fine. If we don't have any, if she's not present, no questions, that's great. Then we can continue to have discussion.
I'm looking for the medical practitioner letter. Could you direct me to the page number? I saw one, but
page
not seeing the double time on it.
Yep. Page 6.
Okay.
That's her bolt.
Okay, page 6. Allow the water additional time. Okay, so there's the double time. Okay.
I think if they allow the little white noise machine and they allow extra time, depending on what we agree, that's fine. I don't know why you do need more than one dry erase board, because you can just erase it right again.
How big is the board? Do they say how big it is?
Okay. They're standard to the side. To the site where they're testing. I mean, they're I don't know.
They're not small. I
mean, yes, I guess small/medium. They're not large by any means, because
we could say 2 and the double time, since the double time is in the medical note. So, and the noise machine.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And the water?
Yes.
The water was always there. That this would be the changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to put this in a form of a motion, Dr. Millott?
Dr. Stewart had his hand up.
All right, Dr. Stewart, I missed you.
Thank you. I have to go back and agree with Dr. Meyer. Where are we at in terms of a threshold for accommodation and looking at the provider? I'm sorry. But in terms of any specific diagnosis of this category, what is a reasonable accommodation? I don't know. Does that depend on the individual and the maybe the testing situation or working situation, or I truly don't know.
It could be severity, you know. Not all people with that same diagnosis have the same level of severity. They may require more, maybe.
But we don't have the severity noted. It's not, I'm hyperbole here, but it's the peacock on the airplane as an emotional support animal. I don't know where the threshold is. I don't know where the line is.
There's my hand. We have done double time. So I have seen that, I think, as an accommodation. So, and I'm assuming white noise is good, I don't think it's getting so excessive, you know, if it's going to help her pass, you know. I mean, now you're right. If somebody wants to bring a peacock in, then taking your comment literally, you know, we're going to have to, I mean, at some point,
we're not there yet.
We're not there yet.
Okay. I just don't want to create a precedent with unintended consequences. So I will defer to what we've done before, which is reasonable.
Yes, Dr. Davis Olson, or Mr. Danner.
I think Dr. Davis Wilson goes first.
Yep. Thank you.
I would have been fine either way. Thank you, though, Mr. Chair. Dr. Malaw, I tend to agree with you. I think that one of the things that helped me was that she did specify how the previous accommodations didn't meet the intent of why she needed them. And I think that makes a little bit of a difference because, I have a child, I have two children with IEPs, and sometimes, you know, what's written in the accommodation is like on paper can mark the checkbox, but the purpose of why that accommodation there is kind of missed. And so I appreciate that she provided, yes, I was provided a separate room, but here's why I needed a separate room and here's how that wasn't met. And so I would agree with Dr. Malaw that I would emphasize that I do feel like this could, you know, potentially set precedents and whatnot. But I think she articulated why those accommodations needed to be a little bit more specified.
You know, the private room is not asked for this time. I mean, the one without windows is not specifically asked for.
Well, I think the site might be limited too, so we have to be careful, you know. So I would not.
And Mr. Chair, so I yes. wanted to just maybe make a comment in furtherance of the discussion portion of this. So I agree with Dr. Mollard's motion. My concern with the noise machine is mostly, you know, how is it going to be contained? Who is controlling the volume? Is it going to disrupt the other students at the testing center and so forth? We definitely want to provide some reasonable accommodations to this applicant, but we can't be in a situation where that is causing an environment that is potentially disruptive to other students who are taking the same exam. So I guess, with those controls or guardrails in place, I would be fine with the double time. It's going to be in a separate room. Hopefully it's well insulated noise wise. Hopefully the noise box, whatever that is, the volume doesn't go high enough to cause disruption outside of the closed room and so forth.
Yeah. I have one and it's just like wind and it doesn't go that loud and it is in a separate room. I don't know.
The purpose of the machine is to mute any outside noise so it doesn't come in. In therapy, we use it for the opposite reason. We don't want what is talked about in a therapy room to get out. So it sort of mutes whatever noise there is so that there it's not an interruption, and I can see how people talking, or if you're checking in someone and I can hear that, could be distracting.
So hopefully it will help.
Yeah, hopefully it will. So I think the question though is like, what are we willing to say is reasonable at this point? And what accommodations are we looking forward to saying yes to, given this discussion?
Again, looking back on what we've done before as accommodations and what's listed in the ASPPB guidelines, I'm certainly in favor of that. As long as we keep the peacocks off the airplane, I'm pretty happy.
Yes, Dr. Stewart, I think I tend to agree. I want to stay in bounds. I think that we have the guidelines. I think that within those guidelines, we can approve those that are contained there. And then we just want to be very careful of going outside of those bounds without some really compelling evidence as to the purpose, the reason behind said requests. Other discussion and then perhaps a motion?
I think I did make a motion? I thought I did, but
yes, you did.
Oh, do you want to restate that? Yeah.
So the motion is to grant her double time to erase boats, the use of the noise machine contingent on the site's ability to ensure that noise is not distracting. I think we should put that in there in case there's a real problem. And what else did she say? And water.
And the separate room?
Yeah, the noise machine would have to be in the separate room. She did receive a separate room, but it had windows and she could hear people coming in and out from what I'm reading. So that's my motion.
Second. We have a first, a second by Dr. Stewart. Any more discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Oh, thank you. Any opposed?
Aye.
That's an aye in favor. Any opposed? Any abstaining? Hearing none, motion carries. Moving on to number, I believe that brings us to 13, correct? Discussion and consideration of possible action regarding proposed legislation, including but not limited to a bunch of House bills and Senate bills. Ms. Pacnon, will you please provide an update on the matter to the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will start with a go out of order where the report is concerned. I'll start with Senate Bill 1457, which was the bill that the Arizona Psychological Association was promoting to establish requirements for prescriber licensure and practice. So as my executive director's report indicated, that bill will not be advancing in this session. I had a lot of communications with ASPA's chair, Dr. Leslie Manson, leading up to the date by which the decision was made for the bill to be held. And what I learned from those communications was that particularly the psychiatrists, their group, they had lingering concerns about, I'm not sure exactly what all the provisions are, but they had concerns about the language in the bill. And the House Health and Human Services Committee Chair, Representative Montenegro, had indicated that the stakeholders could work on perhaps arriving at some consensus relative to the language, but if they did not do so by a certain date, then the bill would be held and not heard in committee. And I understand that they were unable to achieve that consensus in time. So what I have been assured of is that there will be stakeholder meetings that will resume, I'm sure, at some point after the session concludes, and that those stakeholder discussions will be inclusive, that they will involve both the groups from the practicing, the professional communities, and then also the regulators. What I knew to be the case, though, during this last round of negotiations and discussions was that the it appeared that the interest in terms of who to task, what board to task with the regulatory responsibilities, the interest was shifting away from this board and more toward the medical board. And so I assume that that's the point at which discussions will resume. But of course, we don't know if that will change in any way as those discussions play out, you know, in the coming months, maybe longer. So I would say we need to continue to be prepared for anything. And we also need to be vigilant because all along, you know, we articulated that we were concerned about our ability to regulate this area of practice due to the lack of expertise and the lack of spending authority to acquire or secure or engage that expertise. So I don't think that will change as these discussions play out into the future. Any questions about that or comments? So moving through the rest of the list, and I did upload a new list just this morning to the folder because, of course, things change in the course of a week. So I've highlighted just a couple of bills that I wanted to discuss. House Bill 2254, this is a bill that would prescribe any rulemaking agency, if we propose a rule that is projected to exceed $500,000 within 2 years after its implementation, that rule will also require ratification by the legislature. There's a very similar bill later on in this list. I'll sort of speak to them two, the two together. The other bill has a threshold of $1 million, and I think it's within a five-year span of time. At any rate, what I've spoken to in the past is that this bill, I can't foresee it having any impact on this very small agency anytime in the near future. Someday when there are 10,000 behavior analysts and a fee adjustment is necessary, then this, assuming this becomes law, of course, that may have some bearing on the agency's ability to raise the fees. But that's so unknown and so far out into the future. And maybe with that, with those kinds of numbers of licensees, a fee increase wouldn't even need to be contemplated. So just something that, you know, I've been paying attention to. It's not clear to me that this is the type of bill that our governor would sign anyway. So Mr. Wynn is concurring with me on that. So anyway, it's something to pay attention to. So House Bill 2377, it would basically stifle my ability certainly to do any lobbying before the legislature. But what's interesting is that as passed by the House, I see it as a very strict restriction, but then the Senate amended the bill to be, they really watered it down. And so I think as I read the Senate version, I would still be permitted to appear in my capacity as this agency's executive director. So I have no idea how these bills are going to be, or these different versions, excuse me, are going to be reconciled. So I am watching that one. Oh, I'll pause for questions in case anyone has any. I don't want to move too fast. Okay, so Senate Bill 1087. This is the one I'm paying closest attention to. This, of course, is the one that suppresses the level of the agency's fund balance. I think that, you know, there's a room to acknowledge that boards should be very thoughtful with respect to the fees that they charge. They should analyze them periodically. They should make adjustments as this board has done. We've eliminated some fees. We could certainly, you know, take an even deeper look on an annual basis. That's some foreshadowing for you, that we should see if our renewal fees in particular are appropriate from year to year. This bill suppressing the fund level balance at the 50% of the appropriations level. I think that's where most of the consternation occurs because that threshold is so low. So this bill has, again, it's something that it's a recurring one. This is at least the third year that I've seen it. But again, this year it's creeping close to the finish line, but it appears to be not moving to a floor vote, or excuse me, to the Rules Committee. Seems Rules Committee is potentially holding this up. But this could appear on a rules agenda at any point. It could still happen. So this would have a chilling effect, particularly on the behavior analysts, their sub fund and their ability to grow that, which is a concern because, you know, regulating that profession is only going to require more resources as they grow so rapidly. I'll pause for questions here, comment. Okay, hearing none. I'll skip Senate Bill 1255 because it's so similar to one I already addressed. Senate Bill 1270 has gone to Governor Hobbs. So this would require agencies, you know, to provide reasonable space for to accommodate public attendance. There have been some provisions in similar bills, which you know, if I don't have enough chairs available, then I personally am, I could be levied a civil penalty. There's none of that sort of punitive type of language in this bill. It's just, I think it's probably a bill that, you know, most people would find the provisions are not, they're fairly innocuous. I don't think they're particularly onerous as far as even a small agency like us is concerned. Senate Bill 1333, this bill, I think, will go to the governor. So this one is the one that establishes the database of revoked professionals. It does have just a five-year limit on providing that information or publishing that information to the public, but at least it's a start in terms of, you know, allowing the public and boards to check with each other. Are they processing applications for an individual who have had another license revoked by another board? So I think this bill, and reflected by the vote, it's pretty well supported. I think that is all I wanted to highlight. We're coming to the very end of the session, as I wrote in my report, so there will be very little committee action. I'm seeing just a tiny bit next week. So they're really wrapping up floor votes, and we're going to shift to committees. We'll have agendas that will not have bills, but they'll have different presentations, also confirmation hearings. So we'll have one of our own. Dr. Medina will be Senate confirmed, I think, sometime this month. And then we'll just wait for the budget. Bill. So a budget bill that has been presented, budget bills that have been presented to the governor have already been vetoed. And so negotiations have resumed on some level, but have not been particularly public. Any last call for questions or comments?
So just a comment on the accommodating in a public meeting bill. Mm-hmm. So how is that going to play with the fire code? I mean, we can't accommodate, let's say, in a physical meeting more than so many people in a room. We have to comply with the fire code.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Diner, wow, that's a great question. I didn't even contemplate that particular angle. I would imagine that this is the kind of bill that the Attorney General's office may have to, you know, analyze and weigh in on some level. They do that, you know, in the weeks leading up to the effective date of legislative changes. So generally we start seeing memorandums in August. So that may be something that needs to be a factor in that analysis. Other than that, this is something never occurred to me.
So my understanding is that bill has passed and it's on the way to the governor's office. It states that it does not require the agency to hold a meeting in a room larger than it typically holds its meetings. What has been done in the past with agencies when there is a recognition that there is going to be, you know, a larger than normal number of attendees, then they allow for overflow rooms. And for instance, in 1740, it would be a matter of booking another conference room and having audio set up in that additional room to allow for overflow. It could also be handled by requesting that as many people as possible appear virtually. I do think that we will probably have to change the agenda to let individuals know what portion of the meeting, what time that the meeting will be held, where the public space will be open so that they can attend. That does seem to be a requirement of this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. And we do see on occasion, I think that's apparent to us as we've been meeting by Zoom for over 3 years, we will see at times that there's a particularly large attendance. Typically, there are students or trainees that, you know, are attending the meeting. I think that board staff generally receives some advance notice to anticipate a group of that kind, and we very much appreciate it. I think that we also need to probably work with various organizations to encourage them that, you know, we would, it's even more necessary, if you will, that we be notified in advance if, you know, there are going to be another 30 individuals beyond that, which is, you know, our average attendance, for instance.
Sorry, any other questions related to item 14? Not seeing any, let's go ahead and move to discussion, consideration, possible action about the format of our May 5th meeting. Ms. Bakanon?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. So the board had some months ago targeted May 5th, 2023, as the first post-COVID meeting to be held in person. So that was predicated too on certain criteria, one of which, of course, is the room technology available to or such that, you know, it could accommodate our needs. So we have been booked for some time in a room that we knew to be under construction with new technology, wiring and equipment for recording and amplifying the meeting. So the permanent equipment that is to be installed has yet to arrive. There is no ETA either on that. So we simply don't know here on April 7th whether the meeting will be properly equipped on May 5th. So that's unclear. There are a couple of boards that have been using that meeting room, but in doing so, they have either contracted with a vendor to bring in AV equipment, which I can assure you is exorbitantly expensive, or they have invested in some equipment that works fine for that purpose. I have priced that equipment as a short-term stopgap solution, and my concern is that we could be spending $800 to $1,000 for this equipment that we would use maybe in this one instance and never again. It seems we're concerned that it's a cost that isn't reasonable for the purpose of having just, you know, this one meeting in person. And quite frankly, as the agenda is shaping up, I hate to jinx us, but it's very short so far. Obviously, a lot can change between now and then, but we're looking at an agenda where certainly
two of our members would spend much more time driving to the meeting than they would in the meeting. And even some of our members who live in the far Southeast Valley, they might spend more time commuting to and from the meeting than actually being in the meeting. So staff is prepared at this time to recommend that rather than spend quite a bit of money for an in-person meeting that will be short, that will require us to, acquire equipment that may never be used again, we look at shifting the in-person meeting to June 2nd, and the agenda promises to be more robust. But I welcome your thoughts and your direction.
Will you guarantee the current weather conditions?
That is Ms. Michelson's department.
The weather is great right now in Phoenix.
It is lovely.
I agree with you. I think it makes more sense.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes, I think that meetings in the summertime and June and things need to be in Flagstaff or Prescott myself instead of Phoenix.
I second that motion.
Just saying.
Third.
You wouldn't need any equipment. I will provide the equipment for free.
And Dr. Malott has a great setup up there. You've
been to my beautiful room, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've attended. You have a great space up there. It would accommodate the board nicely.
I think maybe even the students can attend.
Yeah, road trip to Dr. Malott.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
All right. So I hear a road trip to Dr. Malott's house. She's putting us all up and we're holding our meeting there.
We have any residence halls, very reasonable, $35 a night. Anyone interested? It's dorm rooms, but.
I'll be the skunk at the party on that one. I think I'm going to stay with Dr. Stewart and his fifth wheel.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I like Mr. Diner's point. Obviously the weather parts are also important too, but I do think that having all of the meetings centralized in Phoenix makes it difficult for other students to have access to the experience. And so I think it would be nice to be able to have meetings in other places.
Just like what we did, Heidi, with the mock board meeting over at Midwestern. I've talked to Cindy Ove afterwards and suggested that we do that, two or three times a year, having the board meet at NAU, U of A, ASU, Midwestern, and just to kind of move it around. I think the very problems we've been talking about, the educating students and educating new members about policies and things like that, I think they'd benefit tremendously. I think the Midwestern students really benefited.
Here.
So a couple of things. Let's give board staff direction about the most immediate meeting, and then we can continue to discuss kind of like the future of moving it around, which I think we've talked about before. The logistics of that, I think we also need to let board staff digest that, of what that means to put this show on the road, and the kind of supports we would need to have for that, and the kind of notice that would have to go out for that. But again, I think everybody's kind of in agreement that Phoenix Central is not always the best look for us. But with regard to this upcoming meeting, like, I just don't think it's possible. So I think at a minimum, the discussion of the June meeting being in person makes a lot of sense.
Mr. Chair, if I may, board staff, I was also just going to add that I had a commitment that was not on my calendar that will make that would have made my attendance to the May meeting in person very difficult anyway. So I am in support of that. Even if there wasn't the other logistic stuff, I was going to have to switch to remote anyway.
So I think hearing what we said, maybe I think I'm fine with the May meeting not being in person. So Dr. Medina, you had your...
Oh, I was going to say, I do agree that it doesn't make much sense, I guess, to have it in person, given that it may, that we don't have, we don't know the state of the room. I am not able to attend the June meeting, but go by all means, if that works better for everybody, go ahead and hold on in person.
Okay. So board staff, are we comfortable with this discussion and direction?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. So we will continue to assess the situation, and I will take a very focused look at the budget for the next fiscal year and anticipate that perhaps there may be, I think I'll look at budgeting two on the road meetings, for lack of a better description. So that'll be something that I'll turn my attention to probably the next month or so. And I'll have clarity soon.
Thank you for that. All right, with that, that's going to move us to 16, future agenda items.
Oh, Mr. Chair, we need to go back to the item 14, the CPQ outreach questionnaire item. That should be a brief discussion.
Yep, I apologize. Discussion 14, discussion and consideration, possible action regarding ASPP, the certificate of professional qualification, the CPQ outreach and questionnaire. Ms. Packenheim, can you please provide us an update?
Of course, Mr. Chair. So I receive survey input requests and invitations all the time, most of which I can answer the questions with confidence. But in this case, I do have to bring a question to this board because it's really, it's a policy issue that I think I know the board's position, but I did not feel comfortable answering the question. So ASPPB issued a survey relative to their Certificate of Professional Qualification in Psychology or CPQ program. So the CPQ is a reflection of standards that the ASPPB's Mobility Committee have established. So essentially it involves a substantive evaluation of a psychologist's training, their education, and their examination results. It's been determined that an individual meets the standards of the CPQ, they are issued that certificate. And that is one of the licensure pathways that exists in Arizona and established in statute. So the question that ASPPB and its committee, Mobility Committee, are posing is this: how would our jurisdiction feel if the ASPPB to issue the certificate required applicants to only come from APA or CPA, that's Canadian Psychological Association or American Psychological Association, or ASPPB National Register designated doctoral programs in psychology to be eligible for the CPQ, meaning that it would preclude psychologists who we would otherwise approve through a different, the typical application pathway, say waiver or licensure in ACCC. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to elaborate, but I'm looking to our ARC members in particular to weigh in on this one.
Thank you, Ms. Beck.
I have all strong opinions, but I'll let Dr. Maya speak first. So,
And Dr. Caterino has raised her hand as well. And Dr. Stewart.
I'll go first. I really think it should be open to students who have, you know, boards have determined they've met the education requirements, and we are kind of giving a private organization the authority to determine. And it really is a kind of, you know, that's why many states, you know, we are in charge. We use those, and it's very helpful, and it's great when students come, makes our jobs easier. We know the standards. But to make that as a requirement will limit CPQs, especially for people who might have come from a non-accredited program. So anyway, that's just my opinion. So.
And Dr. Davey, Dr. Catarino and Dr. Stewart have their hands raised.
So I don't know which one it was, but we're going to go with Dr. Catarino, who hit the physically raise her hand, Dr. Stewart. So we're going to go with her, and then we'll go to you.
So there are exceptions to the rule, because when my program was in effect a million years ago, there was only one accredited program in the nation in that field. And so, but I have a CPQ. So either they look at it, maybe there's exceptions for diplomates or exceptions in terms of the time frame. But, and then also I think, I agree with Dr. Milat that the APA has wanted this, to have all programs and all internships and APA accredited. That was their goal, I heard them say. But it does give them the power to make that decision without us being able to evaluate the coursework of other programs or even international programs. So I would not be in favor of that as a blanket statement without some exceptions. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Catarino, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. I absolutely agree with Dr. Milat and Dr. Catarino. I think transferring power from the public view to a private agency is just not, it's inappropriate. I think we lose the ability to assess students who come from divergent areas that may be well qualified, but because they're not national register, ASPPB, Canadian Psychological, or American Psychological, we're denying them access. I am absolutely against it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart, for that. Mr. Dinar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with everything that has been said so far. I think in our statutes, for example, at 2071.01 in subsection D, we have three separate requirements. And I think the intent of the legislature was to be more inclusive and allow CPQs for students from non-accredited institutions, because there is a separate provision for national register students and diplomate students or applicants. There's also section 2072, subsection D, I believe, where there is the examination exemption provision for diplomates that's separate, and then the CPQ that is separate. My concern is if ASPPB, after this survey, let's say as a board, I'm seeing some consensus that we are against the ASPPB doing something like this. But if it does it anyway, because, we are just one among so many voices, and ultimately if ASPPB decides to make it restrictive, I think we need to maybe start thinking of what we can do as a statutory change that will still keep Arizona an inclusive state where, students can come and get licensure.
Thank you for that, Mr. Dunner. Dr. Meyer.
I agree with everything that's said. I think APA being exclusive is very problematic, and I think at least for some schools there's a movement away from APA accreditation, so I'm in agreement with everyone else.
Thank you for that. Dr. Medina.
I agree with Dr. Meyer's statement. I think it opens the door for issues or creating even like a tier system of licenses, and we don't have that. So if we determine that someone meets criteria to be licensed, that should be upheld, and that would, create problems down the future. So I fully agree with Dr. Meyer's statement and what has been expressed so far.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Dr. Milat.
I just wanted to make a couple of clarifications. The good news is in Arizona, we're very, very inclusive. So even if somebody didn't have CPQ, we have universal recognition. So they're going to get a license in Arizona. So it's not a question. So for me, it's not just a question of what's going to happen here. Are applicants, because of the way we are set up, but it does close the door to CPQ for a few individuals who may not have that pathway, or somebody who graduated a long time ago, or international applications, as was pointed out. So it does close doors. And, you know, generally speaking, I'm not in favor of closing doors because we don't know the long-term consequences. So I just wanted to point that out. In Arizona, because we have so many pathways, somebody who doesn't have CPQ, and in fact, the majority of applicants don't have CPQ, right? You know, some people go for that certification. So it's more of the kind of public-private kind of entities where it's a general sense of objection that I have. So anyway, just wanted to state that for the record because of our inclusive policies here in the state. So.
Thank you for that, Dr. Malott. Ms. Pacman, what kind of action do we need here? What kind of action are you seeking from us on this?
Mr. Chair, I just want the board to affirm on the record that you would want me to respond in the negative to this question, that we would not be in support of that particular type of change. And I can assure you this is something that I will continue to monitor and inform the board if there appears to be any sort of shift in any particular direction. So, you know, and of course, we're sending a nice delegation to the mid-year meeting. I don't know if this topic will come up in any way, but, you know, there may be opportunities for Arizona to articulate in a broader sense what you're stating today. And to Mr. Dinar's point, yes, there are potentially statutory implications for this. I would think that ASPPB, if they were to make a decision to make a shift, that much like with the ECCC Part 2 requirement, the announcement is made that there's a future effective date. And so that would afford jurisdictions to seek modification of their statutes. At a minimum, you know, I think that's something that's fair as a member board, that's fair to ask ASPPB to do instead of making this a immediate decision, if they do so. I have no idea if they will or not, but, you know, to request that the future effective date allows jurisdictions the opportunity to elect what, if anything, to do in response.
Thank you. And do you believe you have enough direction from the board to be able to respond?
I do. You know, if Ms. Galvin feels that a motion is necessary to memorialize this, then of course we can do that. I'm so clairvoyant. I expected the board to arrive at this this decision. But if we need a motion for the record, Ms. Galvin will tell us.
I don't believe you need a motion. The record is very clear.
Yes, I agree. Record is very clear. All right. Any further discussion before we move on to the next agenda item? All right. Thank you, everybody. So back to what I was trying to do. Oh, sorry. Dr. Medina, yes, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. You read my mind before, but not this time, but that's okay. My question is, do we know if there's going to be a vote regarding this as of now, or this is just questions that they're asking?
Yeah, and just for the record, and I'm not commenting, you know, the whole APIC internship process, this change is coming, and that's not an ASPPB thing, but, you know, where APA, you have to graduate from an APA program to participate in APIC. So it's, you know, this is coming more via APA. You know, there's a lot of things going on in the APA world where they're restricting, you know, the pathways, and, you know, people have to come, which is not unusual. Most other OT is the same way. PT, you know, you have to graduate from an accredited program and accreditation. So even for licensure in many, many states. So it's kind of a national thing that is going on, you know, with accrediting organizations. So I have no idea where it'll end up, but, you know, I'm glad we were asked for our opinions. So.
Thank you, Dr. Bob.
And just, if I may, Mr. Chair, just what I understand to be sort of the procedural approach, and Dr. Malott can certainly weigh in as well. So this would be what they're doing is just gathering facts at this point in time. And so, you know, I anticipate that there will be a thoughtful process, you know, once all of the reactions from the jurisdictions are collected and evaluated. The mobility committee will, you know, review and discuss and, you know, consider this matter. Who knows how long that will take or how probative they'll be, you know, in their research and so forth. But they would then possibly forward a recommendation to ASPPB's board of directors to consider. So this, any changes that may or may not come out of this fact gathering process, I think are, you know, quite some time into the future. I don't think this is something that would be, I don't want to say impulsive, but that's the word that comes to mind.
Thank you for that.
Can I make one more point? Just another point on CPQ. We don't do anything with CPQ, but if somebody comes in with a CPQ, we accept it and we grant them a license. So it's really on ASPPBs and who they will accept into CPQ. So from our board standpoint, nothing really changes. I don't think there would even be a statute change because we just accept CPQs. And so people, just the number of people who will be eligible for CPQs reduces to some extent. So I don't see a statute change or anything really impacting us, just the number of people who go that route and then come to Arizona. So.
And this increases APA's income due to the accreditation charges.
We all love it, though. We love having accreditation. On the other hand, I speak on both sides of my mouth. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, thank you for raising both your hands, Dr. Stewart. You are.
Okay, thank you.
Free and clear to speak.
Thank you. I just want to appreciate and recognize and appreciate Ms. Pakanan's and Dr. Malott's knowledge and wisdom in this, because I think we glean from them what's going on and what needs to be done. And I truly appreciate their assessment and recommendations. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Yeah, I think many of us echo that sentiment. Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Additional comments around this? I feel like this is an excellent discussion. Thank you. Thank you, all board members, for participating in that discussion. And thank you, Ms. Backman and Ms. Michelson and the rest of the board staff. With that, we can move to item number 15, future agenda items. Do we have any suggestions from board members or staff as to what we need to include in a future agenda? I think if just from the conversation before about maybe the discussion about future meetings, locations, I think we'll just continue that item. Please, Ms. Backman.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right, hearing none, we can then march on to item number 16.
Move to adjourn.
Dr. Malott moves to adjourn. Who's got the second?
Second.
I'm going to give it to Mr. Wynn. Mr. Dinar beat Mr. Wynn. I was thinking I had it called, but I did not. All right, any discussion around that? Hearing none, very good. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye, very good. Any opposed? Hearing none. Any abstaining? Very good. Motion is now adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for an under 3-hour meeting and a very efficient morning spent. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.